But 2 days earlier, as the Leif Erikson left the Atlantic and entered the underground ocean of Volusia beneath Europe, George Dorn was listening to a different kind of chorus. It was, Mavis had explained to him in advance, the weekly Agape Ludens, or love feast game of the Discordians, and the dining hall was newly bedecked with pornographic and psychedelic posters, Christian and Buddhist and Amerindian mystic designs, balloons and lollipops dangling from the ceiling on day-glow dab strings, numinous paintings of Discordian saints, including Norton I, Sigismundo Malatesta, Guillaume of Aquitaine, Jiangzhou, Judge Roy Bean, various historical figures even more obscure, and numerous gorillas and dolphins. Bouquets of roses and forsythia and gladiolas and orchids, clusters of acorns and gourds, and the inevitable proliferation of golden apples, pentagons, and octopi. The main course was the best Alaskan king crab Newburgh George had ever tasted, only lightly dusted with a mild hint of Panamanian red grass. Dozens of trays of dried fruits and cheeses were passed back and forth among the tables, together with canapés of exquisite caviar George had never encountered before.
"Only Hagbard knows where those sturgeons spawn,"
Mavis explained. And the beverage was a blend of the Japanese 17-herb moo tea with Menominee Indian peyote tea. While everyone gorged, laughed, and got gently but definitely zonked, Hagbard, who was evidently satisfied that he and Fuckup had located the problem in Las Vegas, merrily conducted the religious portion of the Agape Ludens.
"Rub-a-dub-dub," he chanted. "All hail Eris."
"Rub-a-dub-dub,"
the crew merrily chorused.
"All hail Eris."
"Saya dusty,"
Hagbard chanted.
"All that I tell you is true."
"Saya dusty,"
the crew repeated.
"Oh, hail Eris."
George looked around. There were three or five races present, depending on which school of physical anthropology you credited, and maybe half a hundred nationalities, but the feeling of brotherhood and sisterhood transcended any sense of contrast, creating instead a blend, as in musical progression.
"Saya davaktavya,"
Hagbard chanted now.
"All that I tell you is false."
"Saya davaktavya,"
George joined in.
"All hail Eris."
"Saya dusty, saya nasty,"
Hagbard intoned.
"All that I tell you is meaningless."
"Saya dusty, saya nasty,"
all agreed, some jeeringly.
"All hail Eris."
"If they had services like this in the Baptist church back in Nutley,"
George thought,
"I never would have told my mother religion is all a con and had that terrible quarrel when I was 9.
"Saya dusty, saya nasty, saya davaktavyaska,"
Hagbard sang out.
"All that I tell you is true and false and meaningless."
"Saya dusty, saya nasty, saya davaktavyaska,"
the masked voices replied.
"All hail Eris."
"Rub-a-dub-dub,"
Hagbard repeated quietly.
"Does anyone have a new incantation?"
"All hail Crab Newburgh,"
a Russian-accented voice shouted. That was an immediate hit.
"All hail Crab Newburgh!"
Everyone howled.
"All hail these bloody fucking beautiful roses!"
An Oxfordian voice contributed.
"All hail these bloody fucking beautiful roses!"
All agreed. Miss Maurer rose.
"The Pope is the chief cause of Protestantism,"
she recited softly. That was another roaring success. Everybody chorused, and one Harlem voice added,
"Right on."
"Capitalism is the chief cause of socialism,"
Miss Mao chanted, more confident. That went over well, too, and then she tried,
"The state is the chief cause of anarchism,"
which was another smashing success.
Prisons are built with the stones of law, brothels with the bricks of religion,
Miss Mao went on. The hall boomed.
I stole that last one from William Blake,
Miss Mao said quietly and sat down.
Any others?
Hagbard asked. There was none, so he went on after a moment.
Very well, then. I will preach my weekly sermon. Bowls!
Cried a Texas voice.
Bullshit!
Added a Brazilian female. Hagbard frowned.
That wasn't much of a demonstration,
he commented sadly.
Are the rest of you so passive that you're just going to sit here on your dead asses and let me bore the piss out of you?
The Texan, the Brazilian lady, and a few others got up.
We are going to have an orgy,
the Brazilian said briefly, and they left.
Well, sink me. I'm glad there's some life left on this old tub,
Hagbard grinned.
As for the rest of you, who can tell me without uttering a word the fallacy of the Illuminati?
A young girl, she was no more than 15, George guessed, and the youngest member of the crew, he had heard she was a runaway from a fabulously rich Italian family in Rome, slowly raised her hand and clenched her fist. Hagbard turned on her furiously.
How many times must I tell you people, no faking! You got that out of some cheap book on Zen that neither the author nor you understood a damn word of. I hate to be dictatorial, but phony mysticism is the one thing Discordianism can't survive. You're on shit work in the kitchen for a week, you wise-ass brat.
The girl remained immobile, in the same position, fist raised, and only slowly did George read the slight smile that curled her mouth. Then he started to smile himself. Hagbard lowered his eyes for a second and gave a Sicilian shrug.
Oi ce siete, in piccioletta barca,
he said softly and bowed.
I'm still in charge of nautical and technical matters,
he announced.
But Miss Portinari now succeeds me as Episcopos of the Leif Erikson Cabal. Anyone with lingering spiritual or psychological problems, take them to her.
He lunged across the room, hugged the girl, laughed with her happily for a moment, and placed his golden apple ring on her finger.
Now I don't have to meditate every day,
he shouted joyously.
And I'll have more time for some thinking.
In the next 2 days, as the Leif Erikson slowly crossed the Sea of Volusia and approached the Danube, George discovered that Hagbard had, indeed, put all his mystical trappings behind him. He spoke only of technical matters concerning the submarine, or other mundane subjects, and was sublimely unconcerned with the role-playing, role-changing, and other mind-blowing tactics that had previously made up his persona. What emerged, the new Hagbard, or the old Hagbard of days before his adoption of guruhood, was a tough, pragmatic, middle-aged engineer, with wide intelligence and interests, an overwhelming kindness and generosity, and many small symptoms of nervousness, anxiety, and overwork. But mostly he seemed happy, and George realized that the euphoria derived from his having dropped an enormous burden. Miss Portinari, meanwhile, had lost the self-effacing quality that made her so eminently forgettable before, and from the moment Hagbard passed her the ring, she was as remote and gnomic as an Etruscan sibyl. George, in fact, found that he was a little afraid of her, an annoying sensation, since he thought he had transcended fear when he found the robot was, left to itself, neither cowardly nor homicidal. George tried to discuss his feelings with Hagbard once, when they happened to be seated together at dinner on April 28th.
I don't know where my head is at anymore,
he said tentatively.
Well, in the immortal words of Marx, put your hat on your neck then,
Hagbard grinned.
No, seriously,
George murmured as Hagbard hacked at a steak.
I don't feel really awakened or enlightened or whatever. I feel like Kay in the castle. I've seen it once, but I don't know how to get back there.
Why do you want to get back?
Hagbard asked.
I'm damn glad to be out of it all. It's harder work than coal mining.
He munched placidly, obviously bored by the direction of the conversation.
That's not true,
George protested.
Part of you is still there, and always will be. You've just given up being a guide for others.
I'm trying to give up,
Hagbard said pointedly.
Some people seem to be trying to re-enlist me. Sorry, I'm not a German Shepherd or a draftee. Non servium, George.
George fiddled with his own stick for a minute, then tried another approach.
What was that Italian phrase you used, just before you gave your ring to Miss Portinari?
I couldn't think of anything else to say,
Hagbard explained, embarrassed.
So, as usual with me, I got arty and pretentious. Dante addresses his readers in the first canto of the Paradiso, O voi, che siete in piccioletta barca, roughly, O you who are sailing in a very small boat astern of me. He meant that the readers, not having had the vision, couldn't really understand his words. I turned it around, O oi, che siete in piccioletta barca, admitting I was behind her in understanding. I should get the Ezra Pound Award for hiding emotion in tangled erudition. That's why I'm glad to give up the guru gig. I never was much better than second rate at it.
Well, I'm still way astern of you,
George began.
Look,
Hagbard growled.
I'm a tired engineer at the end of a long day. Can't we talk about something less taxing to my depleted brain? What do you think of the economic system I outline in the second part of Never Whistle While You're Pissing? I've decided to start calling it techno-anarchism. Do you think that's more clear at first sight than anarcho-capitalism?
And George found himself frustrated, engaged in a long discussion of non-interest-bearing currencies, land stewardship replacing land ownership, the inability of monopoly capitalism to adjust to abundance, and other matters which would have interested him a week ago, but now were very unimportant compared to the question which Zen masters phrased as getting the goose out of the bottle without breaking the glass. Or specifically, getting George Dorn out of George Dorn without destroying George Dorn. That night, Mavis came again to his bed, and George said again,
No, not until you love me the way I love you.
You're turning into a stiff-necked prig,
Mavis said.
Don't try to walk before you can crawl.
Listen,
George cried.
Suppose our society crippled every infant's leg systematically, instead of our minds. The ones who tried to get up and walk would be called neurotics, right? And the awkwardness of their first efforts would be published in all psychiatric journals as proof of the regressive and shizzy nature of their unsocial and unnatural impulse toward walking, right? And those of you who know the secret would be superior and aloof and tell us to wait, be patient. You'll let us in on it in your own good time, right? Crap. I'm going to do it on my own.
I'm not holding anything back,
Mavis said gently.
There's no field until both poles are charged.
And I'm the dead pole? Go to hell and bake bagels.
After Mavis left, Stella arrived, wearing cute Chinese pajamas.
Horny?
She asked bluntly.
Christ almighty, yes!
In 90 seconds, they were naked, and he was nibbling at her ear while his hand rubbed her pubic mat. But a saboteur was at work at his brain. I love you, he thought, and it was not untrue because he loved all women now, knowing partially what sex was really all about, but he couldn't bring himself to say it because it was not totally true either, since he loved Mavis more, much more. I'm awfully fond of you, he almost said, but the absurdity of it stopped him. Her hand cupped his cock and found it limp. Her eyes opened and looked into his inquiringly. He kissed her lips quickly and moved his hand lower, inserting a finger until he found the clitoris. But even when her breathing got deeper, he did not respond as usual, and her hand began massaging his cock more desperately. He slid down, kissing nipples and belly button on the way, and began licking her clitoris. As soon as she came, he cupped her buttocks, lifted her pelvis, got his tongue into her vagina, and forced another quick orgasm, immediately lowering her slightly again and beginning a very gentle and slow return in spiral fashion back to the clitoris. But still he was flaccid.
Stop,
Stella breathed.
Let me do you, baby.
George moved upward on the bed and hugged her.
I love you,
he said, and suddenly it did not sound like a lie. Stella giggled and kissed his mouth briefly.
It takes a lot to get those words out of you, doesn't it?
She said bemusedly.
Honesty is the worst policy,
George said grimly.
I was a child prodigy, you know? A freak. It was rugged. I had to have some defense, and somehow I picked honesty. I was always with older boys, so I never won a fight. The only way I could feel superior or escape total inferiority was to be the most honest bastard on the planet Earth.
So you can't say I love you unless you mean it?
Stella laughed.
You're probably the only man in America with that problem. If you could only be a woman for a while, baby, you can't imagine what liars most men are.
Oh, I've said it at times when it was at least half true, but it always sounded like play acting to me, and I felt it sounded that way to the woman, too. This time, it just came out. Perfectly natural. No effort.
That is something.
Stella grinned.
And I can't let it go unrewarded.
Her black body slid downward, and he enjoyed the aesthetic effect as his eyes followed her, black on white, like the yin-yang or the sacred cow. What was the psychoses of the white race that made this beauty seem ugly to most of them? Then her lips closed over his penis, and he found that the words had loosened the knot. He was erect in a second. He closed his eyes to savor the sensation, then opened them to look down at her afro hairdo, her serious dark face, his cock slipping back and forth between her lips.
I love you,
he repeated with even more conviction.
Oh, Christ. Oh, Eris, oh, baby, baby, I love you.
He closed his eyes again and let the robot move his pelvis in response to her.
Ooh, stop,
he said.
Stop,
drawing her upward and turning her over.
Together,
he said, mounting her.
Together.
As her eyes closed when he entered her, and then opened again for a moment, meeting his in total tenderness.
I love you, Stella. I love you.
And he knew it was so far along that the weight wouldn't bother her, collapsing, using his arms to hug her, not supporting himself, belly to belly and breast to breast, her arms hugging him also, and her voice saying,
I love you too, oh, I love you.
And moving with it, saying,
Angel.
And,
darling.
And then saying nothing, the explosion and the light again permeating his whole body, not just the penis, a passing through the mandala to the other side and a long sleep. The next morning, he and Stella fucked some more, wildly and joyously. They said, I love you, so many times that it became a new mantra to him. And they were still whispering at breakfast. The problem of Mavis and the problem of reaching total enlightenment had both vanished from his mind. Enjoying bacon and eggs that seemed tastier than he had ever eaten before, exchanging pointless and very private jokes with Stella, George Dorn was at peace.
But 9 hours earlier, at that same time, the Kachinas gathered in the center of the oldest city in North America, Orabi, and began a dance which an excited visiting anthropologist had never seen before. As he questioned various old men and old women among the people of peace, which is what Hopi means, he found that the dance was dedicated to She-Woman Forever Not Change. He knew enough not to try to convert that title into his own grammar, since it represented an important aspect of the Hopi philosophy of time, which is much like the Simon Moon and Adam Weishaupt philosophies of time, and nothing like what physics students learn, at least until they reach graduate-level studies. Only 4 times, he was told, had this dance ever been necessary. 4 times when the many worlds were all in danger. And this was the time of the 5th and greatest danger. The anthropologist, who happened to be a Hindu named Indal Ring, quickly jotted in his notebook,
CF, 4 yogas in Upanishads, Wagadu legend in Sudan, and Marsh's queer notions about Atlantis. This could be big.
The dance went on, the drums pounded monotonously, and Carmel, far away, broke into a sudden perspiration. And in Los Angeles, John Dillinger calmly loaded his revolver, dropped it in his briefcase, and set a Panama hat on his neatly combed silver-gray hair. He was humming a song from his youth.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, those wedding bells are breaking up that old gang of mine. I hope that pimp is where Hagbard says,
he thought.
I've only got 18 hours before they declare martial law. Goodbye forever.
He hummed on.
Old fellows and pals.